Hello, I'm Bridget Monagle, Commissioner at the Victorian Public Sector Commission. Welcome to IPA Victoria's Public Sector Perspectives podcast. I'd like to begin by paying my respects to the traditional owners of the land in which I speak from today, the Eastern Maa people. I pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and to the Aboriginal elders of any other communities who may be listening to the podcast today. The Victorian Public Sector Commission exists to strengthen the efficiency, effectiveness, and capability of the public sector so that Victorian public sector can continue to deliver high quality services to the people of Victoria. We also help grow leadership capability, support the improvement of organisational culture, and advocate for public sector professionalism and integrity. So that's why it is such a pleasure to be here today for this special episode of Public Sector Perspectives, where we get to look up close at an example of outstanding public sector leadership, organisational culture, and a commitment to continuous improvement. In today's episode, I'll be interviewing the CEO of Senatex, Francis Cawthra. For those who don't know, Senatex is a state-owned enterprise that was created in July 2008. It delivers essential ICT services to the Victorian government. These services include identity and network management, security, user workspace, and cloud services efficiently and cost-effectively. And the reason I'm interviewing Francis today is that Senatex was awarded the 2022 Leading Employer Award at IPA Victoria's Leadership in the Public Sector Awards for its Employee Experience Uplift project. The Leading Employer Award category recognises a public sector employer that exemplifies strong leadership in creating a safe, inclusive, and positive work culture, taking a holistic and innovative approach to its people, including adopting smart recruitment practices and creating robust and flexible systems while embracing new and digital technologies. With this award, Senatex was recognised for its holistic approach to improving their employee experience, which in turn helped them to improve customer experience. Over 2 years, Senatex transformed its approach to customers and employees by getting back to basics and treating people as humans first. Working with the business to understand the human experience of stakeholders, Senatex implemented a mix of initiatives to uplift the employee lifecycle from attraction and onboarding to retention. Senatex CEO Francis has a wealth of leadership experience in both the public and private sectors in information technology, large transaction processing centres, customer contact centres, and client relationship management. Prior to joining Senatex, Francis was the Australian Taxation Office for 14 years, including as Chief Finance Officer. Francis has been recognised for her leadership in the areas of financial and resource management, investment strategy, procurement, and contract management. I'm delighted that Frances is here to tell us more about the Employee Experience Uplift Project and impart her advice to leaders and professionals in the public purpose sector. Welcome, Frances.
Thank you so much for that wonderful introduction, and really looking forward to the opportunity and to be chatting with you, Bridget.
So look, I think many people in the Victorian public sector would be well familiar with Senatex, but for anyone who's not, can you tell us a bit about your role?
Thank you. So the role for Senatex, as you did mention, is it is the Victorian Government's shared service provider for information technology services and products. And as you mentioned very quickly, it's about cloud and hosting and network and security, identity, desktop, and all of the sort of workplace support that goes with that. Interestingly, I think the thing that people find a bit surprising is the size and shape of Senatex. So at the moment, we support around 60,000 public servants. And as we know, they were all working from home at some point, or most of them. The network supports about 180 billion transactions a year. And so it's traversed, secured, and then stored, and then retrieved and secured and stored again. We support around 300,000 calls to our service desk every year. In the support of parts of the workplace. We run about 600 odd projects worth anywhere between $40 and $50 million. And we actually manage around 5,500 system changes inside the network. And that's due obviously to the shared service nature of the organisation. We've got some 600 staff as well.
So it's a pretty big organisation, Francis. Do you reckon you could take us back in time and talk to us about the motivation for your transformation program?
So I joined the organization in 2019, and when I joined, there already was a program of big technical uplift and capability uplift that landed in fortuitously December 2019. And so we already had a big program of work. We had roadmaps and we had technical uplift roadmaps. However, we got to March 2020 and pretty much all of that just disappeared before our very eyes. So we knew we still needed a transformation project, but it started to look very different to what it was before COVID. So the idea that the whole of the IT industry fundamentally shift around, what does working from home and being hybrid actually look like in a very secure way. And then, all the questions that all of the public servants came up with is, all those things about, and how do you manage performance? How do you think about people? How do you think about health and well-being? And so really that shifted us in a very aggressive IT market, started to shift our view as to this is the transformation we thought we were going to do into the one that you've actually now seen over the last 2 years. And that's really how it came about.
Tell us more about the project. What did you do and what did it achieve?
So across the last 2 years, there's been a mix of initiatives, and they really start about the uplift of the employee life cycle, all the way from attraction, onboarding, development, inclusion, pipelines, retention, succession. And then underpinning that, we had to uplift, like most people did, the entire technology with which you support that, because we weren't bringing people in for interviews anymore. You had to think of a different way of collaborating with people, engaging people, keeping them, warm, so to speak, as you went through the process. So we started from the very beginning, looking at all that, and then we started to go through. So in essence, there were probably three key things that we saw. One, all about access and retaining talent. And that was all the things I spoke about, uplifting, attraction, etc. The second one that we started to have a look at was all about how do we now, as we pivot out of COVID, how do we create that safe environment? How do we create deliberate spaces for people to be innovative? I always find it a bit confusing when people say be innovative. Well, that's a bit like telling someone to be happy. It's interesting, but it's not helpful. And so what we realized is once we had people and all of our systems in place, how do we create the environment that really is different? All organizations do the undoable in a crisis. They just do. So how do you take that undoableness that you did and actually make it business as usual? How do you create muscle memory and resilience, where you make decisions deliberately through choice rather than crisis? So we started by looking at how do we create deliberate spaces. No one's going to be innovative sitting on a pair of headsets 8 hours a day. So we started with things like we forayed into hackathons, which aren't about coding. They're more about engineering and problem solving in a rapid environment. So we started with that as the first basis of saying these are spaces now where you're cross-functional, there's no hierarchy, you bring your ingenuity to the table, and let's have a look at a series of business problems we want to solve versus technical problems. And that took us to start looking at, well, what do deliberate spaces look like? We've established our own TED Talks where we celebrate people's innovations and things that we need to be able to do in promoting the ability to fail fast, and what does that look like in terms of support? And I think the third thing that we did is all about how do you celebrate those initiatives? How do you celebrate in a real way for people the things that they've actually done inside the organization? And so I think they're the three key things, and each of those had very large programs of work. I don't have the time to discuss today with you, but would certainly have be willing to chat with anyone else that would like to understand in detail the big three programs of work that we ran.
Frances, it's so interesting about how to make crisis and actually focus in sort of peacetime, I guess. And it takes me back to those days of March 2020 when it did seem like Synertex achieved the impossible, when all of a sudden Oh, well, there's 360 public sector workers, and I know you don't support all of them, but like all of those people are now working from home. They're also working from home where they probably got three kids using their internet, fighting over computers, trying to do homeschooling, or they're in a share house and they're all sitting around their kitchen table. And your staff would have been going through those same pressures too. So I'm really interested, how did you manage? Bring those two together. How did you really manage to innovate when you've got staff who are also living through all the challenges of the pandemic as well? And how did you connect their well-being with the work?
Yes, well, the first thing is there's nothing like a crisis to galvanize people behind a rather singular purpose, which was get everyone up and running and working from home. But you are right, our people were going through exactly the same experiences, and one, this idea we started out saying, we're all in the same boat. Well, as you've just explained, they weren't the same boats. Some people in share houses, some people in multi-generational. And from my own perspective, my daughter had her children through COVID and one at school. And, it was very difficult environment to as they closed schools and daycares and everything else. So we did do a number of programs where we started setting up how you would normally drop in on someone's desk. We tried to replicate that in this environment. So all of us as leaders in the organization not just met with the executive teams or the directors, but all the way through the organization, we'd set up to have informal afternoon teas or morning teas, or I'd ring someone, everyone would be off sort of just touching base with people and calling them. We also set up to understand and promote very heavily our employee assistance programs. So it was, and we had a huge uptake around that, and I see that as something that was a really good thing for us to do. And we've continued, we've actually shifted our EAP program now to a group of people who proactively reach out now. So you can actually log on and do your own little study, and from that they'll reach out to you. Or you can, we run all sorts of health and well-being programs as well. So we really did have to start and shift. We also started running CEO Live events every fortnight. So, we would do the big Teams event. And it would be, look, there's no silly question here. Every question's valid, and I will keep. I felt a bit like I was doing my own presser. I'll stay here and answer every question right through to the end, and I won't back off until we've got right to the very bottom of it. So that continuous engagement in all sorts of ways, however innovative we could make that, we did. I notice you've got a lovely set of guitars in the background. We did have some. We had some musical events. And I did think, I think more generally the public service did an amazing job under incredible pressure, as the private sector did around constantly, that constant engagement. It had to ramp up by like 1,000 degrees to make people even feel connected in the smallest way.
Absolutely. And are you still carrying on some of those connection type programs today, even though we're sort of back in this hybrid? Some in
Yes,
the
we
office, some in
do.
not.
Yes. And in fact, we're very deliberate around, this idea that if you're coming into the office, it's got to be worth the travel time, right? So we run anchor days for teams. We run events specifically around culture and training. We've run very large cultural awareness programs. The last one we ran a bit earlier this year was an amazing event, and very highly, and we actually set up to be able to show people remotely what was happening in the office. So as we did these big events, we were doing sort of live crosses between those at home and those in the office, and we've continued to do those. In fact, I just did one yesterday, which was a hybrid event, so the audience could see the home audience and the home audience could see the audience in the office.
And ultimately, do you think that you would have had the same achievements in your success, probably more on the customer-focused side, and made it enduring without the pandemic? Do you think that the pandemic was able to give you the kickstart, or do you think you would have been able to get there?
I think we
without
would
it.
have got there with the program of work that we had decided back in 2019. I think, and I would never want COVID to ever happen again. But I think, in and of itself, it was like a supercharge event that it did shift our thinking about it, but it did give us the opportunity to supercharge. And they say they've got a saying that you can do a week's worth of change and it'll take you 10 years, or you can do 10 years worth of change in a week. And I think the pandemic supercharged the change environment, and we were able to do things much, much faster on the change program because everyone knew you had to do something.
Oh,
You couldn't sit
absolutely.
and do nothing. And so they were so much more, they were willing to give anything a go. Like their appetite really changed. And that goes for our customers as well for us. I mean, understanding their environment, having to get their people home and really concerned about the preparation beforehand. As it was always imagined that Victorian government would work from offices 97% of the time. So no one really had the big scale to have the ability to run people from home, but the appetite to come with us and really scale up what we had was supercharged. And I think, customers really had this view that, and I got a few phone calls going, "Oh, now I know what Synertex do. I never really knew before. Now I've got it worked out." So I think that the environment was like a huge supercharged event. I'm
Yeah,
glad it's over.
absolutely. Transformational and it's exciting, but the thing I worry about most, Frances, is young staff coming through and do they have the chance to observe and be mentored? That's probably my number one worry about it.
Yes, I think the you're so right. It actually has provided a much broader talent pool for us than we've had before, because as an IT industry, we were up against pretty flexible organizations anyway, who really did have some abilities to be able to move. Through COVID, people really saw, though, that the additional flexibility we were providing. And even now, I don't know if you remember, and I was just looking at my watch a second ago going, where you thought, "Oh my God, I've got to be in by 8:30 at the latest, because otherwise everyone, you have to do the walk of shame because it's 9 o'clock." Our view, particularly for anyone with caring responsibilities, if you have to go and do the school run and you're in at 10, that's fine with me. I don't have any issues about how we make this work together. And the biggest thing that we wanted to do when we were pivoting out of COVID was not to lose the lessons that we learned and, do this slingshot back to the way it used to be. And I think what I see around leadership now, there are some people who's, we have all spent a lifetime curating our playbooks around leadership, which essentially went out the window in 2019. But you can see some companies grasping for what used to be. "We're all back in the office 5 days a week. How 2019 of you?" That's not going to work anymore. It really isn't around people's options. And I think that's the other thing that Synertex has been really conscious of when we've made decisions around even recruitment and our employee proposition, value proposition, isn't so transactional anymore. It's not about, "These are my entitlements. This is what you're going to get paid." It is much more about, well, how do I, as a person, come into the organization? Am I going to have some autonomy? Am I going to be supported? Am I going to be valued? Am I going to be able to be understood? Do you have the same values as me? Is climate change important to you? Or, is flexibility as important to you as it is to me? So people are making value decisions now around organizations, whereas once upon a time it was much more transactional. And that's why I don't think we can ever go back, because employees will now just go, "Well, we're not a fit. We'll go somewhere else."
Yeah, absolutely. That sense of what you need to be happy in your job has so profoundly changed, hasn't it? And value does seem to be first, and sort of having meaningful work and being respected and heard at work as well. Which is funny
And
when you say it out loud, you sort of go, well, should have always been that way.
I think the diversity aspect has changed as well, and diversity in its broader sense. I just think it feels certainly for us in Cenotex now a little bit like you just said is how come now we're going, oh wow, this is great. Should have been great back then. How come it's only just dawning on us? However, as a society, I think the value that we place on people and their contribution outside of work is a lot more than I think we've ever done that before. You know, this idea of, you know, the 90s where you dropped your personality at the door and you came in and became an automaton and then you picked it up on the way out was just a nonsense because it was never going to work. You know, being able
Absolutely.
to bring yourself to work was, you were always there in your entirety. You would just suppress some aspects, which in the scheme of the work we did during COVID to get the public servants working from home, I needed everybody in total. They need to bring every crazy idea they've ever had to the table. And that's how we got through.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think from when I was working during COVID, one of my roles was working on, I was in multicultural affairs, working on communications. And one of the things we learned through that was we need exactly what you said. We needed every person that we could get who had experience in cultural and language in other in cultures other than English or traditional Anglo-Saxon, because we needed to understand so profoundly how messages would be both received. And I'm the same as you. I'm going, well, why weren't we doing that all the time? It just blows my mind because I'm like, of course, people who've got parents born overseas are 50% of Victorians. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, we really need to understand their needs and the cultural practice and who do they need to hear from if it's not the premier at the press conference, who will they trust? And those sorts of questions. And I'm still stunned that we hadn't got there, but we changed within 2 weeks. It was amazing, just exactly like what you say. But sort of when you are thinking and looking back on all the work you've done, and there's lots and lots of different leaders across the public sector who want to do a similar refresh of their employee engagement and improve customer experience. So, what would be the top three bits of advice you would provide? Or just one, but what would be your key pieces of advice?
I think first and foremost, one of the things, and it goes to what you've just said about your communications, I think before COVID, leaders, particularly in organizations, listen to respond. They didn't listen to understand. So I think for the big shift is one is you need to listen to understand and stop the compunction, we have to suddenly respond because someone's asked us a question and we have to know the answer. You know, so I'd say really think about that and being really realistic. You know, these big bang approaches, we have, you know, 15 programs on the go and that sort of thing really doesn't run so much anymore. And I think the key thing is that you have to be quite realistic. It's all about incrementalism these days, is how do you shift, know what your dial is. And then, how do you shift that dial? Because that then becomes your step change. So, don't try and do the big 5-year program. Try and keep it really realistic. And the other thing for me is it's a little bit about trusting your people. Like, I should have known this all my life, but they've got 99% of all the answers to what they need. So, but I don't think we give them enough time at the table or enough space for them to become involved. So I really think it is about, you know, your organization, but don't pretend to know your teams. Let them come and be part of it. Trust them to help you do create the organization that you're looking for.
So that's a nice segue into you, Francis, in terms of your leadership style. And as we discussed in the intro, you've had a really extensive and varied career. What are the values and principles that have guided you in managing these sorts of really complex and large organizations? And you've talked a bit about how the pandemic's changed that, but if you could reflect on how it's changed over time, that would be great.
I feel like I have had a very long career, and it's much longer than you think. And I keep telling people I started work when I was 12. So, you know,
What was your
that's
first job?
well, actually, my first job was working during school holidays with my father, who, interestingly enough, used to be a contractor for the Housing Commission, and he ran all the maintenance programs.
Big
So,
job.
he had a number of contracts, and I would go in on Saturdays and earn my $5 and a chicken and chip lunch or something as I went in. But my first formal real paid job was working my way through university in a book warehouse, putting together little packs for children for school holidays with their pencil and the coloring books and stapling them and loading them onto pallets. But I think when you think about, what are the some of the values, one of them I think is I always believe at my real core that there's always a way through. You have to find it, but you might have to go over it or under it or around it or bring different teams in. But with enough brain power at the table, you will find a way through. You'll get through, and that goes a little bit to tenacity. Some people would call it, stubbornness, but I like tenacity. It's a nicer word. That's they're pretty important to me in terms of the values. But principles are things like goodness always wins. Like you have to hold that, not everyone does everything for the right reasons. They do them for some reason. Some of them could be quite personal reasons, but stay the path of goodness always wins. And it will. You will, and you should be doing the right thing, not because someone told you to, but because actually it's the right thing to do, and really holding to those. And one other thing really struck me, and this is about this lifelong learning. It would have been 2 weeks ago. Some of my people went off to the conference, the LGBTI community conference up in Sydney, and they were doing a bit of a debrief on a Friday afternoon with anyone who wanted to join about one of their learnings. So I always had this view that you only need to be brave for the first 10 seconds, right? If there's something courage you need, if you can get the first 10 seconds out, you're pretty much all the rest just follows. But the really interesting view that they came to, and someone was speaking about it at the conference, was how on earth have we created environments where you have to be brave? And that struck me. So for me now, it's about how can I create environments and work with people where you don't need to be brave, you just need to be you. So it did strike me that how did we ever get here is another one of those big questions, like we had before COVID to now. Now I think the next question is, my goodness, what on earth have we done where we've had to create environments for people to be brave to say things?
So interesting, Frances, because when I think about what makes me nervous at work or when moments I need to be brave and I know the other person's not going to be happy with me, that intense need to please. And I think it's pretty universal, and it's not like totally universal, but it's a pretty universal thing.
When people tell me, like you've just said, about how you feel nervous and you feel uncomfortable, I think that's a wonderful thing because that means you still care. If you didn't care, you wouldn't feel nervous. You'd just go in and
Yeah, I
blast
guess
out
so.
whatever would come out of your mouth. So to me, for you personally, I don't think that's about being brave. That's about you understanding really clearly that your role isn't it is vital for the work that you do, and that means that you care enough, you understand the consequence of the conversation you're going to have. So I think people should applaud themselves when they feel like that.
That is very helpful. Thank you. I'm going to keep that in my mind all of the time, Frances, because it actually goes to the next topic I really wanted to discuss with you around integrity in the public sector. And within that integrity, it's also sort of being responsive, providing free and frank advice, which, it's a lot of people are talking about at the moment. Organizations like Senatex, I don't know if people would quite often think about it. Senatex and sort of that idea of that public sector integrity and free and frank together. But from my mind, it's, the work you would do is so core as part of that. The trust that you build with employees and the customers, in terms of the public sector is so integral in terms of providing good service, in terms of people enjoying their work, wanting to provide good services to people. And I'm really interested in your perspective. How do you feel connected to that sort of that public drive in terms of integrity, and how do you promote that within your organization?
I do feel very attached to it. That might have been the, in addition to Victorian government, it might have been the 14 years at federal government that puts that frank and fearless squarely in the picture for me. So I do feel very connected, and I think for some of the things that we went through in COVID, I'm not sure that a lot of people in Cenotex, or I'm sure many people did, but there were a few that found it a bit, confronting that suddenly we were in the position now where we had to provide pretty frank and fearless advice about, I know that's really important for you and your department, but I've got 49 other departments I've got to keep running. And right now I can't do that. So I, where you're balancing out, I don't have, suddenly I didn't have, 43 customers, I had one, and that was Vic Government. And that insight, that real laser light focus, I think really helped. But there were lots and lots of very frank and fearless conversations, can I tell you, about, because everyone needed to be up at the same time, but that wasn't a reality of what you needed. I do think it's interesting times that we live in, and I think everyone's read enough papers to know that public trust is probably at an all-time low right across not just governments but private sector institutions as well. But for me, I think everything starts from knowing that leaders make a difference. And even if it's the smallest difference, if you're making one of those every day, then people will see that. They'll see you taking the front when the hard questions come, not racing down the back and throwing someone else in the front. And so I think really that, breathing deeply, standing up and saying the hard things is the only way, and the right things are the only way we're going to win that trust back.
It's an interesting one with trust because it's so complicated. Like some of the data I see is that people really trust government that they're close to, that they see and they have a connection with, and then the trust l lessens as they get more distant. And whereas, I from my experience in the public sector, and particularly during the pandemic, I just saw our public sector leaders and staff just do phenomenal work, do amazing work in the best, like high spirits. What you say about sort of that drive of tenacity and solution focused and working all hours to produce what we thought was impossible. And because I see it every day, sometimes I'm a bit like, well, why is there a lack of trust? And I do think part of that is we've to go to what you said is we've got to listen to understand rather than listen to respond, which I think is definitely my first tendency to sort of go, okay, right, let's do this solution rather than that sort of, okay, tell me more about that. What are we really trying to get to here? So I do think that, what you've said has sort of really seemed so comprehensive and rounded to me to give me that full picture of how you build trust in the organization and how you create that culture.
There's a funny thing about trust. It's a paradox because you never know you can trust someone until you do. But the very nature of you trusting them makes them trustworthy. So I think, that be brave piece, be brave,
Trust someone.
trust the person, trust the people, trust your people, because I know my people have just, they've done everything they can to make a huge difference, and they have. So I, the organisation and I have been, rewarded tenfold in terms of that.
Absolutely. Do you think was your team delighted to win the award?
Oh, it was absolutely amazing. And I mean, there are a few awards they have actually won. We were certified as a great place to work, and that was the 22-23 year, and that was the the first end of any Victorian government entity to be certified. So we were pretty proud of that. But I think it was this building of confidence. So we won some ARRI awards. We were certified. We were recognised by the Work 180 as women friendly place to work. And I think this all accumulated. And I think the cream on the top was the IP AA award. I think that just made people realize, oh my God, all this work we've done has actually been recognized as a really good thing to do for the organization and of course for government. So it was really the accumulation of 4 years of very hard work, and everyone was just ecstatic.
That's so wonderful, Frances. One of the things, I don't know if you know this, but the Victorian Public Sector Commission does the People Matters surveys, and
Yes.
one of the worst performing results every time is how confident are you that my organisation will respond to these results? And we talk a lot in the VPSC about how you can improve that result within an organisation. And I do think what you've just said. It's like an amazing textbook case study that we can show that it's not, if you want to respond, it's not about having a morning tea or it's not about building, just like having a quiz on the Friday. It's actually about fundamentally hearing and thinking about how the organization works and how you lead that organization, and then communicating with your staff about it, and bringing and trusting them, bringing them along, giving them meaningful work. I'm going to have to direct people to your case study, Frances.
Look, we're delighted to be part of the case study, and it really goes to when I joined Synertex. I say I did a lot of research. I knew exactly the long and arduous journey that Synertex had been through, but at the end of the day, when I was weighing up, the last acceptance piece was, if they've survived as a shared service for 15 years, there's got to be something magical in there, because the world is littered with failed shared services. And so for me coming in, I just knew there was gold here. We just
Yeah.
had to find it, and we did.
I probably have to draw this to a close now, Frances, although I would just love to talk to you for hours. I've really enjoyed this. Thank you so much for sharing your experience. I think that there's some great food for thought there for the listeners in what we should all strive for, what leaders should look for. And yeah, just a huge thank you for your time today.
Oh, look, thank you, Bridget, and thank you very much for your questions. I think they've really had given me the opportunity to bring a little bit more insight to the table. Normally, I'm a little bit more structured, but actually, I found this really comfortable and really thoughtful. So, thank you for managing this in such a lovely way.
Thanks for joining me today for this special podcast following the IPA Victorian Leadership in the Public Sector Awards. I encourage you to continue to be inspired by exceptional design and delivery happening right across the public sector by learning more about the winners and finalists through the information and videos available on IPA Victoria's website at vic.ipa, which is ipaa.org.au. You can stay in touch with what IPA Victoria does by following them on LinkedIn at IPAA Victoria or on Twitter at IPAA Vic. To learn more about the Victorian Public Sector Commission, visit vpsc.vic.gov.au. This program is produced on the lands of Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. I'm Bridget Monigal, and thanks for listening.